Greetings, everyone. This is Koku from the Bitter Medicine Podcast, inviting you to tune in to the Bitter Medicine Podcast on KWAZ Radio.
Peace, family. This is Oni, inviting you to listen to the pro-black perspective, where black problems are addressed with black solutions.
Greetings, fam. Tune in to The Learning Curve with me, the revolutionary matron on KWAZ Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the ninth episode of our interview segment of the Harsh Reality Podcast. And in this segment, we look to bring on professionals, influencers, scholars, and any knowledgeable or interesting individuals to tell their own story and also hear their unique perspective on the news of the day. And personally, I think it's more beneficial and insightful for the listener to hear a person's perspective rather than the traditional question and answer format. So the conversation to be a little bit more free flowing than your traditional interview. So firstly, I got to shout out Melanated Conscious Society, MCS, headquartered in Jacksonville, Florida, is a mentorship organization teaching various life skills, self-sufficiency, and knowledge of self to the youth. Make sure y'all follow them on Facebook and Instagram for the latest news, meetings, and valuable information. Also, shout out to our KWAZ radio family. KWAZ providing the latest and greatest in conscientious-oriented content. Make sure y'all follow them on all forms of social media, as well as subscribe to the Bitter Medicine Podcast, hosted by my brother Koku, and the Pro Black Perspective, hosted by my other brother Oni Tasei. And finally, I am very pleased to announce we have a new member of the KWAZ radio family, the Revolutionary Matron. The Revolutionary Matron with her podcast, The Learning Curve. And you can find her on YouTube. We're trying to grow all of these podcasts and keep the movement growing in general. So make sure y'all subscribe to all of the podcasts and check us out, you know. And lastly, the podcast is now available on Patreon. Please donate. And of course, all proceeds go to upgrading the show and providing the best content we can for our loyal listeners. Also, for those looking to reach out to the show, you know, maybe leave a comment, maybe even leave a suggestion for a guest or something like that. Make sure y'all reach out at theharshrealitypod@gmail.com. Now, without further ado, let me get into our esteemed guest. My guest today is an accomplished author, a podcaster, a proud Pan-African nationalist who's outspoken and unabashed commentary. Personally inspired me to get into this podcast space, so salute for that. And without further ado, I am grateful and highly honored to be speaking to the incomparable Oni Tasei. Welcome to the pod, brother. Oh, you are muted. You hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, what's going on, Oni, man? Good to have you here with the Harsh Reality Presents. Well, I'm messing around with this technical difficulty, huh?
Hey, I appreciate it. You know, always good to hear from you, you know, speak with you, you know?
Yeah, man, had a little hiatus, but it's definitely good to be back. And definitely good to have you as the first guest back on our interview segment. So going in, tell us a little bit about yourself, although our listeners should be familiar with you being one of the KWAZ, originals, I should say. So, any interest in the information you have, your upbringing, maybe your interest in Pan-African movement, or any relevant information you feel like sharing with the listeners that may give them a better perspective on your outlook, you can throw it in right here. So what's up with you?
Well, the most prominent thing about me, I can say, is that I'm an author, you know. I write big books, you know. I write books. I wrote maybe three whole books if you want. But my background for writing each of them really has to do with my upbringing in the Pan-African movement. You know, I was a part of the United African Movement, which was chaired by Alton Maddox at the time. It was one of the most significant movements in America, really, but in Brooklyn in particular, where most every, like almost all of the 90s speeches that we see recorded on YouTube today, you know, whether it's, you know, Dr. Clark or Dr. Ben or Amos Wilson, all of them, well, I like maybe like half of them, right. were recorded in Brooklyn, right? Under the direction of Altimatics. And in fact, Al Sharpton was created through that organization, which is, you know, really a bad thing, but
yeah, I'm gonna say, did he tell him how many people he told on? Why he was
it's a bad thing, but you know, but like that was the impact and effect that that organization had, you know. It created the house Negro, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Like it wasn't a joke. I came in toward the tail end, obviously. I was kind of young, so it already died down from that popularity from before, but you got firsthand seating under under the lecture prowess of Altimatics, and there you learn quite a bit, and it also prepares you to go do your own thing. So eventually I went to go organize an organization I called the African Blood Siblings. We met up every week and we were going over, you know, ancestral wisdom. Eventually I developed further in my consciousness. You know, I went from, you know, what we all kind of gather towards a more international, broad scale view. And then it brought me to the Book of Power, where, you know, I kind of went, like, I took my good roots, you know, those good roots of listening to Altimatics. Those of you who don't know, Altimatics is the best living lawyer in America, right? Mm-hmm. And I heard from him, and he's like a radical. He did pro bono things all the time for Black folk, really defending, you know, the community. Like when Schomburg was going to be taken over by some white people, he sued the state and won or something. You know, or he organized a protest. He was that guy, and the thing about him too is that he was a Black man. You know, that it's really important to get the tutelage of Black men, because here's what he did. Like, if he was, one of the stories of him is that he's in court and he's, you know, talking against this other white lawyer, and you know, and he's telling the white lawyer, you know, what's what, and the white lawyer says, well, you want to go take this? No, I think one of them decided to, you know, say, well, you want to take this outside? And they sure enough go outside, you know, two lawyers. And then they fight, and, you know, Altimatics kicks his ass right in the courtroom. So it's like, you know, like when you have those kind of, you know, role models. And I had like quite, like, there's quite a few, you know, men grab, like, you know, how strong men, you know, we supposed to get together, right? So you had that. Like, I was in that organization, there was another cat. Strong brother, you know, like a lot of strong people, and then you go out, you make your own organization, you attract strong people too, and that just, like, it makes you all the more, it brings up your understanding, and that's what, so if you know about me, that's my upbringing, and that's what I bring to my literature, you know, that developed consciousness that more so emphasizes strength, you know, more so emphasizes victory over victimhood, you know, and more so emphasizes abundance over poverty, you know. And I know you a strong brother, because I know, like, when I think of you too, like, you emphasize that abundance instead of that poverty mindset that you know, a lot of people otherwise have. And so, you know, that's what I could say, you know, about what, like, what my upbringing is just bringing that kind of thing into the Black conscious community.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it too, man. One thing you have to do is you kind of got to speak power into existence. I know, you know, people talk about the manifestation and things like that, but a lot of times, you know, the things that they talk about that are backwards, or maybe, you know, things like that, are things that actually work, things that they actually don't want you doing because they are successful, you know. And one of those things I think is speaking power to existence, which is why I also like the name of your latest book, The Book of Power. You know, that's a title that makes you think that, you know, it's some not necessarily answers, but it's some empowerment in this book. And, you know, a lot of times you don't need to look to outside sources for empowerment, but it's good to have some motivation. It's good to have something to look back to. It's good to have a reference point where if you're running into something, you can kind of, you know, look back to it. You know what I'm saying? And I think the title of a book, that's what's eye-catching. You know what I'm saying? That's the first thing you see. So, you know, this thing is thicker than the King James Version. I think it's a good segue and a good name for a book and a good way to, you know, speak that power into existence. You know what I'm saying? To a certain extent. So you want to give us like a brief summary of the Book of Power and what's your inspiration behind it? And where were you going with it? You know, what were you trying to relay to the people, you know, not to give away too much because we still want them to buy it, spend that money. It's on Amazon, right? But
but yeah. Synopsis. So like that's the thing. It's like, you know, you when you write a book, like I kind of for a moment I went to graduate school. You know, I was going to graduate school for astrophysics, right? I decided to, you know, do some radical organizing. So that kind of got in the way, which, you know, in retrospect was, you know, whatever. But you go to grad school and what you learn about thesis writing, right, is that when you're writing a thesis, you know, when you write a PhD thesis, you have to do something new. You can't, like, if you're doing a master's degree, you can do something somebody else did, and it shows that you have mastery of the subject. But when you do a PhD, you're doing something that, you know, as far as you, your research is concerned, no one else has done, you know? And so one of the things that I noticed for, you know, like Black nationalists, and particularly in America, because that's where I am, right? We don't really talk about nationality and nationhood, realistically speaking. You know, like, we don't really talk about what a nation is. And we kind of have this confused mindset. And a lot of, like I said, a lot of the rhetoric is going to be that victimhood. You know, a lot of that rhetoric, like I was hearing Evolution A Matron, she's another program on the KWZ network, and she's talking about something that Claude Anderson was saying. And no disrespect to Claude Anderson, but he's going on about how, you know, how little wealth we have relative to whites, and how much, you know, like three whites, you know, during the time he's writing his book, three whites during the time of his writing that book, you know, had more wealth than all the Black businesses or something like that. You know, like those kind of extreme things. And it's like, yeah, that's the victim. You know, that's the victim mentality. It's you know, you're telling us a bunch of stuff, and like you said, it's one of the things I didn't like was how much you're telling us all these problems, right? And, you know, without any solutions. I mean, although, you know, some people tell you that Claude Anderson does offer solutions, but the reason why I'm talking about this is that, you know, you have this victim mentality. You have this mentality where we're down. You know, we're losing. You know, we're this, we're that, And there's no definition of nation, right? And when you realize what a nation is, right? When you realize that the nation itself is a group of like let's cut it short. Let's say it's the elites, a group of the elites working together for their benefit. You know, when you realize that, then a lot of the things that you feel and critique against the state or the country or whatever. A lot of times when you say, oh, they have all this wealth, why do they still have 97% of the wealth, right? Or a lot of times when you say, you know, most of the welfare goes to the middle class, they don't go to the lower class, or more of it goes to the upper class. When you hear all that, you realize, well, yeah, if you run in the government, right? If you're the nation, if you run in the government, you're not really running a charity. And you might be like, hey, yeah, but we pay for it. Yeah, sure, you could say that. You could think that. You know, like I just said, you know, three guys, you know, three of them alone could, you know, have more, you know, more money than most people, right? But notwithstanding that, you realize that those three people, right, they're going to go to the government just like you're going to go to the government, but they're looking to benefit from off of what they're given. And they're going to benefit more than you are, you know? And so when you realize what a nation is, you know, you stop with the complaining, right? And you start saying to yourself, well, let me, you know, this is why I need to build. And so whereas the abundance theory, you know, it works good on an interpersonal level, on a personal level. What I'm doing is I'm bringing it into the national level. So one of the inspirations for the book was like the Columbian Orator. It's a white boy's book, but it basically was a older book. Frederick Douglass used it to learn how to speak and read and all that kind of stuff. So did Abraham Lincoln and all that. You know, it's supposed to build up the American character, they say. So I decided first to like build a book that builds up the African character. But also in that sense, I give a bunch of good speeches, but also a bunch of good, you know, good analysis on the speeches. But the speeches are showing you how African people can accomplish if they try, you know, how Garvey is an example of an African who who tried and accomplished. You know, Dessalines is an example of an African who tried and accomplished. Maurice Bishop is an example of an African who tried and accomplished. Nyerere, an example of an African who tried and accomplished. Carlos Cooks, an example of an African who tried and accomplished. When you have these solid examples, you know, as well as, you know, solid speakers, so that, because speaking is really important. It's a really important skill to have, right? So you have your Barbara Sizemore, you have your Afyong, so on and so forth, or your Sister Soldier and all that. But when you have these examples and you can see what our people have done to succeed in the past, that's when you can create something, you know, on a collective level to succeed. And that's what the book's about. You know, and the other part is to, you know, give you a formula for how other people, how every group succeeds. You know, every group succeeds on community centers. Every group succeeds on universities, and every group succeeds on building up their let's say, for lack of a better word, let's say upper class. You know, for lack of a better English word. You know, I can say it in an African word, but let's say, lack of a better English word, we could say every group is building up their upper class. You know,
they're elites. Yeah.
Yeah, they're elites. You know, I was saying like I'll just a tangent, because I'm reading Wretched of the Earth now. And Fanon is saying one of the issues that happen in Africa is they don't have any bourgeoisie. And, you know, he's a socialist, but he's like, if you don't have any bourgeoisie, like what happened with Europe, when how Europe developed was that they had bourgeoisie. And because they had bourgeoisie, they could develop all these mechanisms, all this industrialization. If you're in a country that doesn't have any bourgeoisie, right? That means, you know, you don't have any elite. You're not going to be able to develop industrially. You know, so I'm just giving you that formula on how to develop industrially, how to develop so on and so forth. And that's really what, you know, that's what I would say would be, you know, collective power. You know, there's individual power, of course. But then for collective power, you also want to, you know, follow the steps and follow your ancestors, you know, and that will lead you forward. And there's a whole bunch of examples, by the way, like going back to ancient Egypt, coming, you know, going to classical, you know, got the Mau Mau and all that, you know, everything. So it's a pretty good. Hopefully people feel the same.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You hit on some good concepts there. I kind of want to dive into. And pretty much go to your last point. Speaking of the elites or your class or the people that are pretty much going to lead your people, right? You need leadership. I think people are naturally drawn to leadership. So I think you hit a real good point on that. A lot of people want to talk. That's why I believe like communism, socialism, things like that is a pipe dream, right? I think it's a, you know, sailing the wind. Oh, everybody's equal. We're all
people. Pass the Dutchie on the left hand side, you know?
Yeah, people aren't built like that, man. people naturally gravitate toward leadership. Even if you look at American politics, you know, you got half the people who are worshiping cultists for the orange guy, and half the people are cultists for whoever, you know, the left props up. So they're looking for that leadership, and they're sitting there waiting on that leadership. You know, not all people are built the same. I seen this. Matter of fact, I seen a sister earlier put a post up or someone that said, like, I can't believe that people are that we're on this earth and we're paying for like food and water. And I'm sitting here like, this is an example of why you need leadership, right? Because you can't be equal with this sister. This sister's brain dead, right? Like real talk.
Like, how do water gonna come to her? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, where the food come from? The grocery style. It's like you.
I'm gonna go this while I'm paying for it, but because somebody put it in there, you gotta pay. Yeah. You gotta pay the people. You like you gotta pay the people for their.
Somebody had to raise this animal. Somebody had to feed this animal. They had to slaughter this animal, skin this animal.
You sit on that. Yeah, okay.
You know it's ridiculous, right? So this is why you can't be equal with certain people, man. This is why, you know, socialism and communism to me is a pipe dream, because you need leadership. Sure. You need big brains. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely.
And I think an example are you take from recent, everybody's posting about, you know, Afghanistan, this, Afghanistan, that. In reality, a bunch of dudes in bed sheets and sandals headed off, you know, and stopped and dueled with the biggest empire the world has ever known, the most powerful empire the world's ever known, right? That right there should be like an example that, you know, power, right? When you're determined, when you're a nation, right? When they had a goal, right? You had the American Empire, right? We have a voluntary military. Mm-hmm. One, most of them are there for school money. Most of them are there too. And Americans are funny to me because they paint this picture like, oh, patriotic, the troops, the this, the that. Half these people are there for a charger and school money. Okay. So their motivation is low. But you had another force who are fighting for their homeland.
This fighting is, for their homeland.
Yeah, this is where they stay at. So who you think is going to win that, you know? And they like to bring up this big example of 1776 and the Patriots or whatever. This is the same thing, yo, right? You got the British over here, supposedly, and this is your nation you was born in, so you fought for it, and who won? Even though you're supposed to be less supplied and less, you know, organized and things like that. So you can never... So that's why having a nation, having an identity is important, yo.
One of the most important things for a nation, that's one thing I tend to not repeat, but I think it should be self-evident. I mean, I put it in the book, obviously, but it's land. You know, land is the most important thing. And that's one of the, like, that's one of the issues that we have, is that a lot of us kind of stop talking land, you know? Mm. And when you stop talking land, like, that's where a lot of your problems come in, you know? These guys, for what it's worth, you know, they fought for their land. You know, and they were supported by other people outside of there for them to get their land back, you know, and that's really like, it's something that should click in the head of our people, because we didn't have the advantage of being alive when Vietnam happened. Right. So we don't know what it looks like firsthand, but this is what it looks like. You know, America surrendering to a bunch of people who, you know, well, some people consider illiterate. Sure. Right. But if that's the case, like, what good is all your literacy? You know, like, what good is all your literacy if they're running their government and you're not, and you're being run by your government? You know, like, and I mean, obviously, I'm somebody who writes books, so you know, I can't really talk too bad about literacy. But but I mean, like, if we're being honest, you know, that's one of the things that I definitely also emphasize in my book, is that, you know, I think it says nothing works in theory. All that works. That's like one of the, like, I put it in the front, like the introduction, you know, I say, you know, don't hold any theory too highly, you know, like nothing works. Like, it don't matter if it's in theory, it don't matter. What matters is what you put in, what the work you put in. And ultimately, if you're going to build power, you want to build it on a land that you have. You know, that's one of the main emphasis that I always give. And that's partly why I don't even like that's probably why I tend to encourage people to organize abroad, you know, because if you can acquire land, right, that's where you start building your system. Because I could talk we could talk shop all day about how to organize an economy. Right. But if you talking inside of somebody else's economy, you just talking in somebody else's economy. If you now have your own piece of land, you know, we neighbors, and I'm telling you how much I want to charge for this or that, or what's what, that's where the context actually makes sense. That's where the conversation could be had. You know, you can't have that conversation on somebody else's land. You know, I'm like, hey man, you know, if you know, like the lady was saying, I almost said sister, my fault, but like the lady was saying, you know, if Why don't I get food for free? Why don't I get, you know, like, no. if I have a farm and I'm growing this thing and I'm working, like, I want stuff too, you know? I want stuff too. And because I want stuff, then if you want the stuff that I have, you got to give me something, you know? And that's just common sense. Exactly. You know, I'm not sitting down growing crops for free, you know? You know, like, I mean, or if I'm growing the crops, that means I want something in return. And I know for damn sure that this woman ain't growing nothing. No, you know? No. You know damn well she ain't growing nothing. So why she, like, why would she get anything from me if I'm growing stuff, if she ain't, you know, like, what do I get from that?
Exactly.
You know, a long time ago, you know, this American, like, a long time ago, America said it would stop slavery, you know, well, stop slavery outside of the prison system, right? But it said it would stop slavery. So then I'm not working for free. That's it.
Exactly. And then, like I said, like, you send these people to these schools and they get these ideologies implanted into them, the public fool system, I know you like to call it. And you can tell who's the victim of the public fool system. Yo, they are walking around zombified. And the longer it goes on, right, it's almost like making a copy of a copy, right? You make a copy of a copy and it gets worse, right? Mm-hmm. So now you're making copies of copies of copies, you know. And I've known some people going into the teaching field personally, and I'm like, you're somebody sending their kids to you, bro. Sure. I've seen you in high school. Like,
that is, like, I'm telling you, that's what it is sometimes. You know, that's what it is sometimes. It's terrible, but again, like I said, you know, I try to like that's the society we're in. They want us dumb, you know, because you know, we have to realize, like, this is what they teach in their universities, you know, and that's the thing, that was the most important thing about, that's one of the important things about this book too. So I do different ones. There's let's say there's four types of education, right? But we're gonna just break it down into like two tools, right? One of the types of, I mean, basically, I try to differentiate between Eurasianists and Africanists, right? So I say that, you know, you can have a Eurasianist education and African education. That's like one education is focused on Eurasians, other education is focused on African. But the other one I want to really point out is this commoner versus elite education. And this is something I learned in the UAM, you know, because Alton Maddox told us, he said the seat of power in America is Yale and Harvard. And I was like, what? I never heard that in my life, right? But, you know, you realize that the elites of America, right, the people who run in the America, and they brag about it. You know, they brag about it. If you pay attention, you know, back when you was applying to school, you heard they brag about how they all go into these same elite schools, right? And you realize that when you go to the commoner schools, right, you know, just the regular universities, when you go to those regular universities, you ain't learning the same thing, or you're not connected with the same people that you do at Harvard or Yale. And it's the same with, you know, I learned about UK. UK, you know, you have Cambridge and Oxford, right? Now, you have other schools in the UK, right? And that's the schools that we go to. But they, their elites go to Cambridge and UK. And we remember this because, you know, when Bush was president, they were talking about, oh, he's a part of Skull and Bones. He's a part of this. Like, they are a part of, I don't want to say secret societies because they're not, you know, everybody know about them. But they're a part of societies where they are ruling, they're ruling the country. They're ruling their country. And it makes a lot of sense. And what I'm saying is that people organize nations around benefiting that upper class. They have schools for that upper class, that elite, you know? And then you look at us as African people and you realize we don't have that. And not just that, the Africans who go to schools, go to universities, most of us went to, most of the African leaders went to commoner universities, like in the West. One of them, I'm telling you right now, I was surprised. I'm looking through the education thing. One of them went to DeVry University. he wrote in the country. He went to DeVry. And people who not, like I said, like, you know, sometimes I try to pretend like I have an international audience, right? So I try to explain to them what DeVry University is, right? DeVry University is one of them TV commercial universities. you ain't learning nothing. You ain't learning nothing about running a country in DeVry University. You know what I'm saying?
Like, you're not, but you're not even building that, the relationships. Like, you're not even building.
Bush goes to well, I don't remember if he went to Harvard or Yale. I can't remember, but he let's say he went to Yale, right? Bush went to Yale, joined a group called Skull and Bones or whatever. He's connecting with the people who are going to be influential to the point where not only his father becomes president, he becomes president. And he don't become president off of like some merit or some genius or whatever. He becomes president because he was inside of some society where people that go there rich, you know what I'm saying? Whereas, and the thing is that you as a black person, you could go to Harvard and you not be invited to those schools. And what's interesting is this. I want to point this out. One of the things I put out in the Book of Power was Marcus Garvey telling you this exact same thing. He's like, you could go to the same university as white boys, but they have these extracurricular like fraternities, and that's where they get the real lessons, you know? So they're really learning. Like, I'm not going to say that George Bush learned how to manage a country because, you know, I'm from New York. I so we don't have that great opinion of George Bush. But what I want to say is that if you would ask me who had a better circle, like if George Bush could have selected from quite a handful of individuals to run this nation, right? Whereas if you go to DeVry University, you make some connections, and you all the way in the middle of Africa, you make some connections at DeVry University. You know, even if you had like you're not, your country's gonna tank. you already know. You don't got to look. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're just going to tank. It ain't even complicated. Like George Bush could at least put some, you know, people in high places. You know, he could make a few phone calls and get some people who know finances or who knows this or knows that. You know, in the traditional Wazungu way, of course. But
and then, you know, presidents aren't picked anyway. Presidents are chosen.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a whole system where they put these places. They are vetted. They don't even let these people come close to it unless they serve a purpose. And if you know anything about the family lineage, I'm not going to go too deep into it because I'm putting this on certain platforms. But, you know, anything about Bush and them daddy, then you know why he's in the, which is kind of weird why he's in. But, you know, do your own research into that family and you will see like what's going on here. But a lot of times, even if you look at other countries, like you spoke on one of the leads of the country being from going to DeVry University, but they do have, you know people that are running different countries or whatever that they've propped up, the American Empire has propped up, and they do go to these elite universities and they specifically send them back to be the puppet for them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But like, that's the thing. It's like, if you go into Wazungu's elite universities, you're gonna serve Wazungu's elite. You know what I'm saying? Like you're not gonna go like that's the issue. It's like if I go and study Plato and Socrates and so on and so forth, I'm not gonna start spitting Garvey. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like because you know that's one of the issues. It's like, yeah, you even if you went to one of these elite schools and like you're still gonna be serving the people who gave you that education. You know, exactly. And that's the thing that happens. Like, even if you were to go to like Shanghai University or whatever, right? You're gonna be pro. Like, I see people who suddenly pro Chinese, and you like, what's the educational background? Yeah, they was educated in China. Mm-hmm. Like that's part of what education is for, and that's why I'm trying to convince African people, you know, our people, like in this book and whatever. But I'm trying to convince us to build up our own independent Africanist education system so that our people can be that Pan-African that we need to be, you know, Pan-African and skilled and connected, you know, because that's what Wazungu's doing, or that's what every other group is doing. You know, every people have their elite schools and their elite universities and connect their elites together in order to run their nation. You know, like you said, they choose their leadership among themselves, and they vet their leadership, but they also know that their leadership went through some sort of educational process. Whereas our leadership went through their educational process. Our leadership went through their vetting. And because of that, that's like something that I feel like that's what I articulate in this book, but that's what I say, you know, that's what I want us to understand and really like read into so that we can, you know, really create something different. Because if we're not creating that, it's always going to be the same way, mm-hmm. you know? Because I want to say this, you know, again, you know, I point out already that was happening in Liberia in 1900. They were talking about the Americo-Liberian being educated in the West and pretty much selling out the country because of his education.
Word.
And that was in 1900.
Word.
And of course, all these African countries come later and they're doing the same thing. But white people know what to do.
Right. You sending your children to be educated by people who do not have their best interests at heart. What do you think? It's the most asinine thing you can think of. And then you have people arguing to get their kids. We had this pandemic go down, which has been a perfect opportunity to, you know, talk to your local politicians and get some school choice, where as though the money follows a student. Now you can pay the tutor. Right. Now you can get a five or six of your homies together because you get $20,000 a piece and hire a teacher to come through and teach them something good, you know, and teach them something relevant, teach them, make your own curriculum, right? Mm-hmm. But instead, you got people out here fighting to get these peoples back to the indoctrination center, because that is the babysitting factory for them, honestly. Mm-hmm. They set up a perfect system where, though, you don't have a parent at home no more, you know, or, you know, the people don't want to stay together anymore. So now you have a single parent home. So now, or even if you got two parents, both of them got to work. Mm-hmm. You know, it really doesn't matter. You're still sending them to this babysitting center, which is an indoctrination center, which is, you know, masquerading as an education center. You know what I'm saying? Exactly. And they're fighting for it. And then even then, when they send your kids home, they ain't even in the building no more. You put them in front of a screen so they can be indoctrinated. You know what I'm saying? It's the most asinine thing I've ever seen. So
like I'm saying, like the more you study, you say to yourself, I don't see how. you know, like we like we coming out winning. You know what I'm saying? I don't know how we coming out with the W. You know what I'm saying? Like,
they set up is just so. That's why I say I to get in my little conspiratorial bag, it gotta be algorithm running things, because there's no way, if you look at these head figures, which they have some people that's behind the scenes who are doing things, but if you look at the Bushes of the world, if you look at this dementia patient they got propping up now, if you look at all these things, and you're like, no way they can figure out this system that's so, you know, so devious, yet so, you know, just interconnected, just so ingenious to a level. Like, you can't just figure that out, yo. That takes thousands of years of planning. That takes a genius mind to figure out. And I don't think they got it. Like, I think it is some algorithms going on or something, because there's no way, man. Yeah. It's just a genius system, man.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's roll that into the some Haiti talk, man. Let's talk about Haiti, bro. So between the assassination of the president, now we got the earthquake going on. What's next for the Haitians, man? Like, and why is there such an interest in the island, man, from America to the UN to different countries, you know? And lastly, what can we do, if anything, to, you know, help or maybe change the direction that's going in, or what do you think the Haitian people can do to help themselves? So I'm gonna toss that to you.
Oh yeah, so Haiti. Haiti. I mean, like my thing is that I don't really have the optimism. I mean, I'm not really too optimistic about much things. That's one of the things that, you know, a lot of people won't like about me. You know, because I try to tell like an ISS. You know, I try to give you reality and not, you know, a lot of people want you to feel good. I don't want you to feel bad per se, but I want you to see the truth. You know, so as far as Haiti, I can't say like again. You know, like you just said, it comes back to leadership. You know, I mean, obviously their leader was killed, but, you know, even before he was killed, you know, people were thinking that he was like a butcher or a leader of gangbangers, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And already you also see, with regard to the earthquake, somebody pointed out, for instance, that Japan is more prone to earthquakes, you know, but you wouldn't see the same thing happening in Japan, you know, partly because Japan is industrialized and, you know, industrial, what have you, right? But partly also because if you are earthquake prone, right, your leadership should make a real effort, an honest effort, to make it so that your houses are earthquake proof, you know? In Haiti, I heard, in fact, that there was like some sort of charity where the person, one of the people on the board, was running a concrete architecture, something like that. So they're building concrete homes, knowing full damn well that concrete is bad for earthquakes. They're building those homes and they're profiting from people donating to that to that organization, so that they can build more homes that are. And if you saw these videos, you would like concrete homes dropping on you, mm-hmm. Right? A lot of people lost their lives. So far, the count is like over 2,000 people lost their lives in a matter of seconds, and partly because of this housing kind of thing. But so I would just recommend, though, just to say that one thing that we can do is we could. I'm not going to say it's going to change the world, but you could donate. I donated some money to Hospital Karamad Les Cayes, right? So they had their own little thing. I said, let me donate. I'm not going to say that's not going to build the earthquake proof homes. That's not going to industrialize Haiti. What, you know, the solution for Haiti would be that better leadership, that leadership that focuses the economy more intelligently. But as far as what was the interest in Haiti, you know, one thing that people don't know. So Haiti used to be Saint Domingue. I'm going to open that up. Saint Domingue, right? Right. It was the richest colony in the world. You know, it was the richest colony in the world right before the revolution. OK, it was the leader in the production of sugar, coffee, indigo, cacao and cotton. Let me see. Hold on a second. It was. Let me just pull out this reference. The world's top production of sugar and coffee. It was about like 60% of sugar produced on the world, you know, 40% of coffee produced in the world. In fact, at its peak, it outproduced even though it's a small territory, it outproduced the entire Spanish Empire in the Americas. It was like a gold mine in terms of agricultural productivity. You know, the thing is this, though, that it's not this, like, you can't do that. I mean, and not that you can't do that, but you would need leadership to do that. You would need leadership to bring it back into that sort of productivity. And not just that, you know, you have to be, one of the things that a lot of us don't really get about economics is that even if I produce, let's say I produce 1,000 oranges a week. Yeah, 1,000 oranges a week, right? You know, I have a big property. I could just produce 1,000 oranges a week. The reality is this, that I'm not going to be wealthy unless I can sell 980 oranges a week.
Yeah, so supply and demand, bro.
Yeah, exactly. If nobody wants an orange, you know, or if I just have these, like, I'm not necessarily wealthy. I might have a lot of oranges, you know, but, you know, I might have some good vitamin C levels. But outside of that, I would need to be able to either sell or trade these oranges. And so one thing about the global economy is that because you have to sell your goods, you have to, as an African people, you have to either trade your goods with, you know, people within your nation, you know, find a way to trade it internally or trade it externally without this over dependence on Wazungu. You know, Wazungu is white folk, right? But without this over dependence on white nations, because if you have this over dependence on white nations, the reality is that they can undercut you, you know? And not just that, you know, you also have to get further into, you know, economic thinking and try to make some sort of productivity, some sort of add some value, manufactured value to whatever you make. So your oranges, you could sell, you know, bottles of marmalade or something, right? But I'm saying all this to say that, yeah, with regards to Haiti, yeah, you need that kind of leadership, either some Pan-African political economy that where we're engaging with each other, we're engaging with Haiti, and it's producing all the sugar, but or it's producing all the sugar and coffee, but we're selling it to other African countries, or we're producing all the sugar and coffee, but we're or it's producing all this food and we're getting this food to our own people. But if we don't have that kind of leadership to bring it in that way, because a lot of times the leadership is just kind of stealing. A lot of times, like leadership across Africa in particular, is just kind of accepting donations and loans to facilitate their own personal lives and grafting and grifting, partly because that's what they learn in the West, but they still do it. So there's no excuse, right? If that is the, yo, why is this full? If that's this, this case, right? If that's the case regarding that, then we have to, yes, it's going to be the same over and over again. You know,
and then if you look, one thing I said, well, you had the earthquake in what, 2010? You're looking at roughly what, 11 years ago, right? Death toll over 200,000, right? And then they supposedly rebuilt the houses. How do you have non-earthquake proof housing if all these entities, you had the UN in there, you had this Clinton Foundation building houses supposedly? How are your houses, how are the houses there so prone to demolishment from another earthquake that's about roughly about the same, you know, strength as the previous one? You know what I'm saying? Like, it just doesn't add up, right? It doesn't add up. And that's what happens when you depend on another person. Getting back on what you say, you're depending on somebody else economically, you're depending on somebody else humanitarian, you know, whatever they want to give, whatever they want to contribute. And guess what? You're going to get the crappy concrete, right? They're going to rob you. They're going to take whatever donations there, and they're going to give you the worst of the worst in terms of housing. They're going to prop up some houses that they know are going to collapse again. And now, guess what? Now we're going to repeat this cycle 10 years later, right? You're going to get mad donations in. Some people going to be promising to build up your nation, build up, you know, these houses that was done and help people. And in actuality, they're going to rob and give you, you know, second rate material and prop up a couple houses, make it look good. And then in 10 years, we're going to talk about this again. The definition of insanity, doing the same thing, you know, expecting a different result. That's what you have right here, right? So you're right. You are definitely correct. Somebody needs to figure out some way economically where you can enrich your people, enrich your country to a point where you don't need foreign entities to come in and rebuild stuff. And you may can take it as supplementary, but your infrastructure itself will be built by people who actually care about your island, care about your people, right? And
yeah, but see, the thing is that you learn, you go into DeVry University. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, man, like, you know, it'd be all good and well if you learned all that, but you know, like,
or even then, let's break it down. Like, what wouldn't it benefit you if, even if you have a economy that's not great, right? Wouldn't it benefit you to send those people to maybe, you know, what's the best school in you know, Nigeria or something like that? You know, what's the best school in this area, right?
That's a good ass question. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying. Like, our people have not focused on the educational. We have not focused on the education. So, you know, the best school in Nigeria. You know, like here's what it is. At the end of the day, I think Pio Lumumba says it, right? But, you know, we all kind of know it. The politicians of Nigeria would send their kids abroad because they know that the universities where they're at are not where it's at. Mm-hmm. You know? So it's like, you know, we really have to focus on communicating to our people the need to create our own adult education, you know, and really stick to it, because that nation building mindset, you know, the mindset of how to develop an economy, the depth of political education or an economical education, all of that is not going to come through Wazungu School. I studied astrophysics, so they weren't going to really teach me that anyway. But like, from the classes I took, they weren't talking about nation building. You know, because let's be honest, Wazungu got no reason. Like, there's no reason for him to teach you nation building.
Well, they had no reason to teach even their own if they're at the
nation. Exactly, because they already got a nation. Exactly. You don't got to teach people in a nation about nation building. You know? Exactly. The people that need to learn about nation building, people that, like, for instance, the person like Afghanistan, the Taliban needs to learn nation building. That's what they need to teach themselves. You know what I'm saying? like that's who needs to be able to be learning it. You know,
can you even teach nation building? Is that something you just got to do? You just got to have that charismatic leader who's determined. Now, nation building is nothing but a nation building, you know, from the ground up, is nothing but economics, infrastructure, and things of that nature, societal issues, in terms of how to take care of your people. And that's about it. You don't really have to go to school to learn to build a nation. You just need to go to, you need to send somebody to school to know how to work economically, right? Know how economics work, know how to build an economy.
That's what I'm saying. Like, so, all right, so when I say nation building, that's what I'm saying. That's another thing that I'm saying too, is that a lot of us, when we talk nation building, we just kind of say it. So what I'm saying about nation building, I'm trying to say too, like, I want us to study civil engineering. You know, I want us to study military engineering. I want us to study war military strategy. I want us to study what was it? What was the other one? Oh, census taking. You know, I want us to understand study practical sciences and so on and so forth. So as to say that, you know, these are the subjects that, I mean, obviously, you know, we learn some of these hands. You know, I find that banking is a really important one, right? But these are the subjects that we might kind of touch on, but like, it depends on how you're being taught it. But these are also the subjects that if you're not learning, like you could be that charismatic leader, because for sure you need those charismatic leaders, right? But the trouble is this, like, this is one of the things that I was, like I said, I'm reading Fanon, and Fanon is saying, you know, they had these charismatic leaders in Africa, right? And what they would do is they would just kind of, Like they would sell you a bunch of nice words, you know, think you're Tariqs and so on and so forth, right? They sell you a bunch of nice words, but when it comes to economic sense, they were not developing the economy, you know? And so when I talk about, when I say nation building, you know, I'm saying that you're going to teach people to be charismatic, of course, right? But you also want them to understand how to, you have to understand what independent economy, you know, you also want them to understand the need for civil engineering. you know, the need for, because we might say, hey, you know, that's common sense. And it's common sense for somebody smart like you. You know what I mean? But the thing is that there are grifters in the African community all over the world, you know? And because there are grifters in the African community all over the world, you have to, you partly want to empower people to identify that, but you also want to empower people who might not, like, who might be misled by these grifters, you know? Like, you know, yeah, because the thing is that it's all too, like I said, when I was younger, I was, you know, I was into this Black nationalist stuff, but I realized a lot of people not talking anything, you know, that they want you to, you know, put on your kente cloth or what have you, which is nice, it's good, okay, whatever, but they're not teaching you that you need to have like you really need to facilitate this civil engineering, you need to facilitate this this military engineering, because like you said about this earthquake proofing, like you're not gonna have that problem in Japan,
right?
You know, like Japan is prone to earthquakes. You're not gonna have, you know, 2,000, 3,000 people dying in Japan because of an earthquake, you know?
Right. But that's kind of why I switched, because I was a big, like, because if you study history, so study COINTELPRO and things like that, the first thing they did, once they brought down a charismatic leader, that was it, right? Stopped the end of the movement, right? That's because a lot of these places, they actually didn't have a set mission or a set strategy. They had an idea of a mission, or they had an idea of a strategy, but they didn't have that goal. If you look at China, China has the fastest rising economy in like history.
5-year plans, you know?
Because they have a mission, they have a strategy. So yeah, you need the charismatic leader, but if the charismatic leader get knocked off, which he's gonna get knocked off, it doesn't matter, because you got a dude right behind him to pick off. It's not like a lack of charismatic leaders. You have plenty of charismatic people who can take the reins and run with the baton, but you need that set mission so they can run with it. You know what I'm saying? And
that's what I mean. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's why I think like a lot of us are missing, because when you start talking about civil engineering and military engineering and war strategy, like teaching people war strategy, teaching people this, like being intimate with that and making sure that the leadership understands this at least a bit, and then having people around them that understand this a lot, you know, that's the whole difference. Because like you talk about military strategy, like I'm not going to say that the Taliban and the Americans, you know, blah, 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 but the Taliban's did what they had to, you know? They did what they had to, and now, you know, the task for them is that, because a lot of us don't realize this, but Afghanistan has maybe 40 million people, or yeah, 40 million people on 38 million people probably, right? And then Kabul, the capital, I guess, had 4 million people, right? They now have to direct 4 million people. They now have to direct 40 million people, you know? And that's why, like at the end of the day, like this is like firsthand view of what's going to happen. Can they direct 40 million people? How do they organize themselves to do that? And then also moving into the future, you know, with the weaponry, you know, do they engineer new weapons? How do they go about with that? You know, obviously I'm not trying to give no advice to them, you know what I'm saying? But what I'm saying is, you know, because America still listens, you know, but what I'm saying is that, you know, this is the same task that we will have in Africa, where we might, you know, have 40 million people, 3 million people, 4 million people. And then you're going to have, and then the thing is this, the people who arrive on the top, you want them to have a consciousness that is not greedy. Right now we have we have very greedy, very Euro-centered people coming into leadership. I saw this documentary on churches in Kenya. And boy, I tell you, man, they're selling, like they had this guy sitting in a coffin, right? Acting like he dead. Then the pastor come over and like massage him or something, and then he come back alive. And it's like, and everybody giving this guy a bunch of money. He flying planes, he doing all this stuff. And it's like, come on now. You know?
Yeah.
Nah, man. You got that. First off, you shouldn't be lying to people about how people don't see that you can't be doing that. Ain't no way. Like, you know, but that's what's gonna happen. Like, and if you come and you're on, like, you want the people that take over, or the people that entered leadership in that country or any country, that has this kind of bizarre thing going on. Because, you know, that sort of, you know, church abuse happens everywhere, right? But if you have people that come in and they could put an end to that, you know, put an end to the church abuse and also, like, refocus the people's energies into something productive, something meaningful, different fields that will bring us forward, you know, where you talk about, like I said, the civil engineering inside of Haiti, where you go to Haiti and you have civil engineers, you have, because here's another thing I want to say about Haiti. This is what happened. 3 days before the earthquake happened, right? People were talking, there was, like, I guess in New York or something, was like, there's an earthquake coming. And at the same time, there was an earthquake in Haiti, there was an earthquake in Australia, or not Australia, Alaska or something like that, right? But the thing is that you have to have the technology. You have to have the scientists that are the geologists who are on point saying, look, there's an earthquake coming. It's, you know, brace yourself. You know, don't be in the building right now. Or whatever it is, the solution for an earthquake. But just, you know, go to earthquake zone or something. You don't even have that. You just have people who are just chilling in their homes, not really getting any, you know, obviously their president just died, sure, but not getting the communication going on. And then that's it. Lives lost because we don't have that kind of leadership. So, you know, yeah, you might you could have the charismatic leader, and that's really important. You know, I emphasize speaking and public speaking all the time, but you want to give people that, you know, like one of the things I really encourage people to do is to look at it from a vantage of, if we had a nation, if we inherited 40 million people, or if we had whatever, how can we direct it, you know, so that those people can be can really afford a lifestyle into the future, you know? Mm-hmm. Because what the leaders of Africa are doing right now, what the leader of Haiti was doing, you know, it was just killing opposition and pocketing money and inviting anybody to come and build over there so that they could get some money. That's not going to bring you anywhere.
Which,
you know,
is a good segue into the next topic, which is the economic talk. So you just mentioned money. You mentioned African leaders taking, you know, basically money to enrich themselves, right? So yes, you have entities like the IMF, you know, basically they are in charge of world currency, right? Economic growth. They can decide your nation's credit rating. People don't even know nations have a credit rating. It's like foreign to people, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you know that these people control these elitist people control the economic growth of any African nation, any melanated nation for that matter, is there even a way to break through the paradigm? You know what I'm saying? And we all know macro and microeconomics. You should know, you know, macro, the larger sense, you know, a micro more so your personal finances, right? Mm-hmm. We all know micro leads into macro, right? So that leads to financial literacy. That's the basic tenet of what you need. That's like the atom, right? Is there a lack of that financial literacy among the population, particularly in the United States? And, you know, could that be a reason why it's such a lack, you know, of the macro? You can't lead into the macro without the micro. So what you got on that, man?
Yeah, regarding that, I mean, like, a lot of people tell you, okay, well, like, this is the basic quest, the basic solution, not the basic solution, but the basic answer that people give, which is, Pan-Africanism, you know, black people coming together, acting as one nation, and then they could engage IMF some way. And, you know, it has its merits, you know? It has its merits in the same sense that what happens with regard to, like realistically speaking, when the IMF approaches a white country or an Asian country or any other country, right? They, you know, IMF says, here's a deal that I want you to sign. And the other country says, wait a second, I don't like line 32. You know what I mean? Wait a second, I don't like this line. Hold on a second. If I'm giving you this, you got to give me this, right? It's a real negotiation, right? When the IMF goes to an African country, they say, and they give a worse proposal, you know? They give a worse proposal. And they go to, you know, before the person even read it, they say, yeah, put my signature on it. Where's that money at? You know what I'm saying? because I don't want to say the IMF isn't malicious. Like we got to realize, I think one of the things that we, like, this is one thing I really want to communicate to people too, right? Is that when we say Wazungu, like when we talk about public school, public school system, when we say Wazungu's miseducating you, you know, White man's educating you for his benefit. You know, like when we say he's not educating us for our benefit, that makes sense. But he's educating us for his benefit, and that makes a lot of sense. You're not going I try to take it, like I said, make it realistic. I kind of make it so that you could kind of see it through this white boy's eyes too. And so the way the white boy, like, you got to say that I'm not going to educate your kid for your benefit. You know what I mean? Like, why would I educate your kid for your, like, why would I put my resources into your child for your benefit? If I'm going to use my resources, I'm going to use it for my benefit, right? So the IMF is saying to Africa, right, you got some good resources, right? Like I said, Haiti was the richest colony on the planet, right? You got some good resources. You produce sugar, you produce coffee, and you're the main people producing sugar and coffee and importing it into Europe. If my economy is about me, is about you providing me with raw material. You know, I think that the economy will work as long as you provide me with raw material. The IMF is designed to benefit the IMF. You know, it's designed to benefit the world economy. It's not even deceiving you. The thing is this, it's not deceiving you as much as it's just an organization that is going to benefit the people that is running it. You know, like every organization is supposed to benefit the people running it. That's what I want people to understand. Every nation is supposed to benefit the people running it, because nobody else works for free. You know what I'm saying? If we have this mentality, I call it the Black Panther mentality, really, but like we have this mentality where we should just like give other people for free, like, you know, just like lose all the time. And it's like, yeah, that's nice, you know? Yeah, it sounds Christian, you know? But, like, not everybody's going to do that. And so IMF, yeah, you know, you don't have to be a part of the IMF, right, per se. Obviously, the IMF will do what it can, or the Americans will do what it can to get what they want from you. But that's, like, just common sense, right? But as far as the IMF is concerned, it is economically developing you if it's gearing your community towards, you know, if they call them three sector idea, but the primary sector being raw materials, if it's gearing you towards raw materials instead of the secondary sector, which is manufacturing, and manufacturing is where the real wealth would be, right? But right. If it's gearing you towards raw materials, then it is technically benefiting, it is technically developing your economy so that your economy facilitates theirs. You know, right? But I mean, like me, it's like, at this point, I'm like, I can't even blame white folk for what they're doing. Because it's like we are just of this opinion that white folks should just be doing stuff for us. You know, the white folks should just come along, like they should travel all the way to Africa, leave their homes and just develop our economy. You know, but it don't make no sense. Like I'm not going, like I would not go to China to develop China's economy. You know, I would not go to Europe to develop Europe's economy. I do not expect nobody Chinese or European to go to Africa to develop Africa's economy.
What are they doing it? But like you said, it's for,
yeah, for them.
Their benefit. You got
it. Exactly. If I'm going to China, I'm gonna get mine. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you got whole towns in Africa right now full of Chinese workers, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Getting this, because that's what you're supposed to, because China's just like, oh, we got a lot of people, you know, we got a lot of brothers, we got a lot of men.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And we gotta send them out there, do too. Something. Yeah, keep that in mind, yeah. Too. They need women, like,
I heard that because they kept killing their girls for some reason.
They only had one child, so guess what? So now you end up with a whole country of hard legs.
Exactly.
You need women now, right?
Yeah, so you sending them abroad to go, you know, get abroad. You know what I'm saying? Now, I don't want them coming to Africa for that, but, you know, sure. But yeah. So as far as that's concerned, yeah, I think IMF, like, IMF is going to do it. Like, white folk going to do what white folk going to do, right? But our thing is to get that powerful African nation. And if you have that self-sufficiency, you don't really got to worry about what other people want from you. You know what I mean? It's like when your money's right, you don't like if your money ain't right, right? And somebody tells you, you know, somebody with money tells you to go do something, you go and do it. But if your money is good and somebody with money comes along, you're just like, okay, well, that's good for you. You know what I mean?
It's funny too. And I was listening to this character of the day talk about basically a lot of things like this cancel culture, right? It was one of them celebrities, one of the white celebrities, the sportscaster, right? And he was talking about how, you know, because he's against a lot of things, against some restrictions that's going down, things like that. But he said, but basically his point was, I have F you money, right? I don't care. You could cancel me, you could come troll me over the internet, you can do whatever you want to do. I have F you money. Now, if we expand that out to a nation, right? You have F you money. You need it, right? Exactly. You don't care. You don't care, right? And that's what you need, right? You need that base. You need that financial base. Well, I don't care what you do. We got this stronghold right here, right?
Exactly. If you could defend yourself and you could feed yourself, you're good.
Yeah, you don't care. Yeah.
You don't care? You know what I'm saying? Like, because the thing is this, IMF existed during the rise of China. I don't know if India is rising per se, but during the rise of India, during the rise of during the rise of Russia, probably wasn't around during Russia, but it was during the rise. Like if you can just tell, like Russia said, F you to the rest of the world, right? And then it built up itself. You know, I mean, I'm not pro socialist or nothing, but I'm just saying Russia did that. China did that. Okay. Cuba did that. Right. Now Grenada was doing that. Grenada is an example that I used, the black example. It was right next door to America. It was doing pretty well. Very good economic sense. But then they just didn't have the military. They couldn't defend themselves. You know? So you have to, like I said, you give those examples, you learn from those examples, but you also have to realize that, you know, that's what it is. So I mean, yeah, the IMF is going to be a problem as long as you got people trying to work with the IMF. As long as you got people who can't see through the IMF. As long as people who don't understand that. But if you can navigate outside of that, if you can develop capital on your own, if you could feed your people, develop that self-sufficiency. Because one of the things that the IMF will do, it'll tell you not to. It would sabotage your food sufficiency. Mm-hmm. You know, like you sign up, your people will sign up and be like, oh, yeah, we're not going to do this. So and so forth. You, if you doing that, if your people no longer food sufficient, because see, if you could just get that, you know, Liberia, for instance, was able to produce a lot of rice, you know, but right now it imports rice for the last 100 years. But if you got Liberia could actually produce this rice, you got Haiti that could actually produce this sugar. You know, you got, you know, another country that could produce, you know, like has a whole bunch of cows, right? You can have a lot of people eating porridge. You know what I'm saying? Or rice pudding or whatever. Whatever it is that you can make with rice, sugar, and milk. You know what I'm saying? Like, whatever that is. You know, you can have a lot of people eating. So, you know, what we could do as a people, if we as African people really focused on a pan-African economic sense, of course we could do that. And you know, as far as like financial literacy with the black population, you know, yeah, like you really need financial literacy on the upper echelon. I mean, you need financial literacy on a lower echelon too, but you really need it on the upper echelon, because if your people, if your leadership is selling you out, like things is going to be harder for you. You know, I for instance, cryptocurrency is big now. The president of Nigeria tried to cut down on cryptocurrency in his country. Like he was like illegal, like making it, yeah, like all sorts of impediments for people doing that. Or even this dude shut down the, like said, you can't be on social media. And a lot of people probably doing like their businesses on social media. A lot of people, you know, attracting people on social media. You, like if you got the leadership that's cutting into your pocket, right? Like you could still navigate, but like it's impeding. There's an impediment. So yeah, you want that. Like, you want that financial literacy, but also, like I said, if your leadership signing out around the dotted line all the time, you know, like it's like that's really one of the biggest problems. You know, like black folk in America, definitely, you know, obviously they should have some financial literacy. But the thing with America, and I kind of say this, and you know, people don't really like that for that. But the thing with America is that you don't control the ports. You know, you don't control what comes in and what goes out. And that's like really gonna like hamper our economic development here, you know? Because like if you can't export or import, like that really hurts you, you know? Like I said, Haiti could, you know, if potentially it could send its sugar abroad, and you know, and Liberia potentially could send its rice abroad. But you know, if America's saying no, you ain't sending nothing anywhere, right? Then like what? You know what I mean? Like you like it's tougher, you know, or it's really tough if you're in a nation of foreigners who can impede you. Because you know that
I think you have to be, not to cut you off, but I think you need to be forward thinking, right? You speaking on trade lines and things like that. You have to be forward thinking when you're coming up against somebody who has a system already in place where they control it. I think you hit a good point going back with crypto, right? Exactly. Crypto could have been an escape, honestly, because it sprang up on people, and a lot of these people who have these old money people didn't see this coming, right? They didn't really plan for that, right? That was a chance right there, because you got to make bold moves if you're going to rise out of you know, the bottoms. If you're gonna raise yourself up, if you're gonna empower yourself, you have to make bold moves, right? Mm-hmm. You can't inch your way up to the top. You have to make a bold move in order to get a foothold, in order to, you know, boost your economy, boost your nation, boost your people. And crypto could have been a move where if all the African nations say, hey, we Dogecoin, we all gonna convert this to Dogecoin. This is what we rock with. You want to give us a, you gotta give it to us in Doge. We don't care if you want this oil over here. You want this, you know, this cobalt. If you want these resources that you need to make these cell phones that everybody has, because a lot of that comes from Africa. They can even make cell phones without the continent of Africa. But anyway,
absolutely.
If you want it, guess what? You got to come with this Doge, and that's what we finna use over here, right? And you could have did that. And now, guess what? Now you can make a move. Now, hey, these people got to convert to Doge to be able to sell you this, right? You have how many people in Africa that you can do business with? That's why it's the number one place where people are trying to go, because it's open, right? It's some place where you have opportunity, have potential, rather than America where you have, you know, 5-6 corporations that dominate. The Waltons and the Bezos of the world control everything. If they don't want you in the club, you ain't in the club, right? Over there, you don't have the Waltons in the Bezos. You can actually make a foothold. Okay. You know what I'm saying? So that's the number one place where people who are trying to buck the system are going. And you could have made a major move, but you got to be a visionary and you got to be bold. And you don't have either one of those. They want
no risk, no reward, man. You know?
Yeah.
So I would say that, like, financial literacy, yeah, definitely. Like that's a must, you know. Garvey teaches that in his Message to the People. You know, that's a must. But again, like I was just stressed that if you're a nation, like if your leadership is not that visionary, it's not that you just want that, because like here's the thing with Africa is that, you know, you have the leadership that could sabotage the people, you know? Like it could sabotage. Like if you're advocating for something, you know, it could kill you. You know, like they could jail you. They could imprison you. You have maniacal, you know, one thing that we kind of take for granted, and you know, it's not really too granted. I mean, it's more so like white people could, you know, say this better. But, you know, in America, you kind of sort of have that freedom of speech. You know what I mean? You kind of sort of have that, like right now, you know, we talking crap. I'm talking crap about how America lost a war. You could do that here. You know what I mean? Like I wasn't even sure you could do it, but then I saw so many people doing it and I was like, okay, sure. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
but
like people talking shit right now. You
I know, right? You just like,
lost in a wave of, you know,
I was like, well, I thought he was all silent about this thing. Right. But yeah, because like, you know, in other countries, you really can't do that, you know? Like you say one thing about like one wrong person, you know, because that's what the thing we used to do when Bush was president. We used to talk crap about him or whatever. But like you can't really do that. And these other countries, man, they'll beat you. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that you know you can't say everything in America, obviously, right? But yeah, these other countries that you gotta be mindful of the leadership. You gotta be mindful of the rights that you have. You gotta be mindful.
But yeah, that's why I hit on earlier. Like, that's why you gotta have a mission, right? That's why you say like the Taliban. Taliban's fighting for the homeland, right? So they're determined, right? And you have to, you know, I think the revolutionary matron hit on this. I think she's big on like spirituality, right? African spirituality, right? You have to get back to these systems. These systems are very useful because it kind of teaches you that, you know, death is an end all be all. I think you have some people who think that, you know, we've been taught by these, you know, Western religion systems and things like that. They're like, all right, you're dead, you're going to heaven, that's the end of your mission and stuff like that. Whereas though, if you go to the more spiritual systems, it's more so like, hey, you might come back to suck it two or three times to get it done. Like, you're not gonna, ain't no heaven, hell, we all interconnected. It's a universal consciousness that we all come from. Energy don't die, you just transform. So how the hell can they kill you, right? So when you get all this, and I even read something earlier talking about how the Vikings, like how they would basically take some drug, I forgot what the name of the drug is, that would get them hyped up, like almost like a spiritual experience where they hit the land and they hyped up and they just slicing and dicing, right? Going through, they don't care about death, they don't care about their own mortality. We going through it. But you have,
don't tell Shakira, she about to do on a, she about to go on a race. You know, I mean, she about to, I'm joking. No.
Oh, for real?
Nah, I was just joking, Shakira. Right. I'm just saying the Vikings high or something. Just chopping away, you know, with some hotness. You know, I'm just
big 6'3", blue eyed, coming through, you know.
But, exactly. But we like, all these zombies.
You know? You had this fear of death, man. This huge, like, end all be all. That's fear. When you're able to be controlled, man. Fear is the biggest control mechanism you can have. And that's why you have people right now that are just trying to enrich themselves and don't have a greater purpose. And so they're just trying to, you know, get their kids money before they kick the bucket and build their own legacy rather than build a legacy with this country, right? Which is bigger than anything. You'll be in history books if you can build this nation, but you have to have that non-fear of death, man. And even if you go out, you're a martyr, right? And those are the people that make changes, man. But when you like think the end all be all is death, you're gonna stop at a certain point. You're gonna be like, all right, I can say this, but then I have to and it's not even. And we were to the point where they're not even just scared of death, they're scared of like losing their job. Like, you got people who are muzzled right now because it's like, I make $16. I don't want to I'm not gonna say nothing about my job. My supervisor's friends with me on Facebook, so I'm gonna shut up. You know, like we're to that point that, you know, where you scared to even speak your mind. So that First Amendment stuff is trash to me because it's like, you scared, they may not jail you for your words, but they'll take your job. You won't get hired nowhere. You're free. You lose all your.
Oh, yeah, America don't play neither. But nobody really plays. Be honest. That's the thing. Like, because I mean, like, again, like, I want to look at it from an upper class perspective. Like, America's not interested in, like, the people running the show ain't interested in stop, like, sitting on the sidelines. You know what I mean? And like, that's something that we have done. Cause I remember this. In fact, like, this is something that happened. This was something I heard about, was that after the election of Biden, I guess, right? The guy, Mike Pence, was like homeless or something. Allegedly, he was like homeless maybe for a few days. Maybe he still is homeless. I don't know. But the thing is that it dawned on me too. It's like, where do you go after being the vice president or the unpopular vice president? You know, you're not going to be, you know, like, so he's like just like living off of some governor in his state or something like that. But that's like, if, especially since I don't know if he was grifting or not, but like, usually politicians are grifting.
They see him as a traitor because he talked, you know, crazy about 45. So you both side, and he side like you. So he kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's like, but that's the thing. It's like, if you're not grifting, if you're not stealing or whatever, and you work it, like if you work at a job for 4 years, right? And then you really can't find a job after, you know, or there's no job quite like it, you know, like a lot of people are going to steal. I'm not saying I would steal. I'm not saying that you would steal. But if you don't steal, and that's what happens, that's what a lot of people are thinking when they're working this 4-year job or this 8-year job or whatever, is that after that, what are they going to do? How are they going to feed their family? You know, because the people don't really have a plan for you, you know. You out, and the next party comes in, and the next party is gonna tear down everything you've done, and you know, make sure that they hunt you down or something. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that, you know, being realistic, because you know this guy Mike Pence, you know, like you said, he might have started talking about Orange Guy, and then like he's not going, like, what's he gonna do, flip burgers? You know, like, what's he gonna do? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, I'm not saying he can't flip burgers, but in fact, that's what I heard before. Like, Allen Iverson was like seen flipping burgers. Like, nah, I was like, Allen Iverson, like, you talking about financial literacy,
like those casinos and those whores, man.
Like, it's like, I'm saying, I don't know basketball, Well, I know Allen Iverson. You know what I'm saying? Like, if this guy's big, you know what I'm saying? So, like, how you don't got no money after, like, come on. You got to have some damn
sense. That's regular. Like, I heard 60% of NBA players go broke within 5 years.
Of yeah, but it's like, that's what I'm saying. Like,
financial literacy, right?
Yeah, it's financial. Like, financial, there's something wrong. Like, because if I had that kind of money, man, I'm telling you, I'd be straight. You know what I'm saying? Like, shit. I'd be straight. I don't know about this. I you know what I'm saying? It don't make no damn sense, but
All right, well, let's roll that to the next. And this would probably be the last one, man, because I don't want to keep you more than an hour, man. I know we.
Oh yeah, my fault.
Well, we good, man. I like this conversation free flowing. This how I like this pod. But we got the perceived diaspora wars, which is, you know, I know you've seen a lot of, you know, FBA and ADOS, you know, talking about Pan Africans, and it was mostly to me was regulated to social media. But I want to throw it to you. Do you think it's serious? Like just a social media, you know, construct, maybe a psyop. You know, you got a lot of bots running around. And in all honesty, Ken, you know, the ADOS, FBA, and you know, the regular African Americans, you know, the normies I call them, and the Pan Africans, and even those from the continent. Can we find a middle ground? You know, before I toss you that question, I say I've been to Afghanistan, right? I've seen what was out there, right? Afghanistan is not this, never been a united country, right? They've been thousands of years of infighting, and they have beefs and things like that. What they have is warlords in every area, but these warlords have come together when they need to, right? Like to kick America's ass, right? So, So what you have is, that's not necessarily, you know, the same, you know, people with same goals and missions, but when they need to, they'll come together, right? Yeah. Right, the warlord thing. Can you have like a similar system with these different competing groups here? And like I said, do you think the diaspora wars are a real thing, or is it just some people on Twitter who ain't got nothing to do in bots?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I think it's both. You know, it's a psyop. But it's a psyop, it's a, you know, a social media construct, but it's also like technically it has a foundation, you know, because like I said, I'm reading this Fanon guy, you know, Wretched of the Earth, you know, I finally decided to read it. I was told to read it like 20 years ago or something. And I was just like, sure. But, you know, it's kind of like, it was kind of boring. I'm not going to cap, but I started reading it. And so, you know, he's talking about how there is this, he's in North Africa, you know, he's in the 1950s, 1960s, and he's talking about this chauvinist versus, this chauvinist and nativist view versus this Pan-African view, you know, this African unity view. He's talking about, you know, let's say in Senegal, let's make up something, but in Senegal, they have some Sudanese people, and they want to kick out the Sudanese people because they feel like they're impacting the economy kind of stuff, you know? So that's just a normal thing, a normal thing that happens like all over the world, you know, all over the world. You have a people who, if they're going through something economically, if they don't have FU money, right, they're going to look at the closest thing and try to blame them. Right. You know, with regard to African-Americans, we already know that things are going to be Like African Americans, unfortunately, you know, Martin Delaney talks about this, right? Unfortunately, the way how Europeans organize their society is that they always have an underclass, right? So in certain countries in Europe, you have the Poles. In certain countries in Europe, you have the Gypsies. In certain countries in Europe, you had during his time, the Jews, right? And so what happens in America is that they also have an underclass, and that underclass is inevitably going to be the African Americans, right? It's just that way, you know. America's never going to. I mean, it's very unlikely, you know, but it's very unlikely that America would accept Black Americans as their social equal, you know. Let alone that they would have the Black Americans being the social equal of the white elites, you know, because again, the white elites are not trying to be social equals with the white commoners, right? So they're definitely not trying to be social equals with black Americans. So, you know, a lot of times you compare the economics of Black Americans versus white Americans, and you're comparing it to like the richest people on the planet, you know, like these white guys, you know, who are like literally like they don't care for their own poor. You know what I mean? So they're not going to care for you. But so you have Black Americans in this perpetual state of impoverishment, right? Now, obviously, as an individual, you could rise up. But, you know, one of the other things you're going to pick up on is that, you know, you have this factor called the tourist. I'm going to start with the tourist factor, where if you're a tourist or a foreigner, right, you're going to do better than the native population on average, right? Because if you're traveling around the world, and like you've traveled, right? So if you're traveling around the world, you're already doing better than most people. You know, you're already doing better than 95% of the population of the planet, you know? Because, you know, like for instance, if I'm trying to fly to Africa, it's already like $2,000. You know what I mean? Especially if I'm flying with family, it's already $2,000. I already gotta pay for this.
Recruit office down the street, bro. You can get free travel if you want. You know, not to cut you. You know what I mean?
Hear you?
No, you can't hear me. Can you hear me now?
No. What'd you say?
I can hear you now. I said, if you want free travel, bro, all you get the recruit office down the street, brother.
Yeah, okay. I was meeting these Taliban for some reason. They'll be like, what was you saying? What would you say on your podcast?
Hey, you want to travel for free? I got you.
They'll be like, what'd you say on the Harshality podcast? I'll be like, wait, hold on a second. anyway, I'm good. I can pay. But I'm saying is that, you know, if you're traveling, you're already better off. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm traveling to some African country, I'm already better off than the people there, you know? And just the same, if you're coming from Africa into America, you're not going to be as poor off as the worst of the African Americans, right? And because the statistics are going to be skewed in that sense, you know, one of the things that ADOS people do is that they would use the statistics of being a foreigner. But here's the thing. If you're a foreign white person, you're doing better than white people in America on average. You know? Like, the average income for white Americans might be like 50 to 60, whatever. Like, the average income for white foreigners is like 70 plus. You know, 70, 80. And, you know, it depends on what country you're from, because, like, the Indians got, like, this huge, like, 100-something. But the thing is that the point being is that if you're traveling to another country, like you said, you have to have a mission. You already have financial literacy. You have a mission. You're going there for a reason. You know, you're basically invited. You have some economic viewpoints or whatever. You know, you're not necessarily like you're coming from Haiti. You're not necessarily the poor and indigenous. Sometimes, most of the times, right? You might be the person who's like, when I go to America, I have this plan, I have this community, I have that. And that's not something that we on average have when we're born and raised in America, you know? Now, you could develop it on an individual level. You could get that financial literacy, and you could surpass most of African-Americans, most African-Americans by just that. Now, are you going to do better than all African-Americans? No. There are some historical Black neighborhoods that are well-to-do, you know, well off. And of course, like, if you're a foreign white person, you might do pretty well as a foreigner, like on average, but you're not touching the white elite, right? All that to say that, you know, notwithstanding that, if you're like, anytime you're in a, anybody could rile up the national, poor, right? Anybody could rile up the national poor against the foreign poor. And say that the foreign poor, not that we're poor, but, or not the foreigners are poor, but just to say that, you know, like even though they're not like super wealthy, you know that they're a little better off. You know, they have a little this, they're a little that, they're a little this, so on and so forth. You could always do that. So there's a real thing there, you know? And you know, I don't want to bring up, you know, the classic example of somebody rallying people up against another group, but you know, I know it's like everybody thinking it, right?
We know,
yeah, exactly. Everybody thinking it, but like it's easy to do. It's just that, so is it real? But the thing is this, that we also have to understand the social media scene. Like, if you knew who Yvette Carnell was, you know, Yvette Carnell used to be a part of That other guy's thing. He's like a, you know, I don't want to describe him in any negative way, but that guy, she was a part of, like, she was like an underling for him, and then she got to a feud with him, and basically she was pretty unpopular. She was pretty cast away.
Oh yeah,
she
he got some good cultists too. You might want to.
Yeah, exactly. She just hit a nerve. She just struck a nerve like a gold mine. Because, like I said, that consciousness could be exploited. She just exploited that gold mine, and now, of course, Tariq is exploiting it. But realistically speaking, it's just a part of internet streaming culture. You know, there are like white boys who make a fortune playing video games, you know, making YouTube videos, making that kind of content. She's just a YouTube content creator, and she just struck a gold mine in regards to, you know, just getting at the scratching an itch for black consciousness, you know, scratching an itch against other black. But that's like, and like I said, it's just a common thing. This is a xenophobia. It's just normal. You can see it everywhere. Yeah.
Is it she of correct me if I'm wrong, but she's not straight, right? She's lesbian, oh,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, definitely.
And now
you're white girl, interracial lesbian, like.
And we noticed a theme, right? What else we had that was a very popular movement? We had the BLM, right? Mm-hmm. And if you notice, a lot of these movements, man, are not exactly supposed to be conducive to the black male, right? You don't really see a lot of black family, black male talking these movements, kind of off. But that brings me also back to, you know, getting back to the diaspora wars, right? What we got going on, right? One thing I've kind of noticed, right? If you notice, there's been a big push for Nigerians in America, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's been a big push that almost like Nigerian is accepted. If you look at the UFC, right, the top fighter, they three of their champions in the UFC of Nigerian. You have a lot of in terms of sports leagues and things, a lot of African, particularly Nigerian athletes are being hoisted up and stuff like that. If you look at the institutions, there are a lot of Nigerian elite sending their kids, like you said earlier, to here to be educated. And it's almost like they're accepted. One of my good friends is she's Bulgarian, right? And she actually dated Nigerian brother. And she was telling me, you know, low key that that basically it's almost like a thing of like you've made it, you know what I'm saying? Like if you're dating, you know, a white woman, like it's like bam, you bam, you know.
Like, and then she Bulgarian, so I mean, actually no, that's your friend, I'm not gonna say nothing, but
she good people.
But I was gonna say there's other countries, you know what I'm saying? Like, I never heard, you know what I mean? All right, but anyway, go on. Yeah,
and so you know what I mean. So I always find that kind of interesting, you know what I'm saying? But and also you hit on something too. The best education is traveling. That's why it's so expensive to travel, because once you get out there and you experience all these different things. One thing I read that was kind of very interesting. I don't know if it's true or not. Maybe you, because you're a little bit more schooled in Garvey's history. They said the brother never went to the continent.
Oh no, they stopped him. Like the thing is that he was finna, like, basically the way how the West looked at Garvey was like the way how the West looks at like Bin Laden or something. Like they thought he was a terrorist, pretty much, according to them, you know, because he's talking about decolonizing Africa while Africa is like 99% colonized, you know. They don't want somebody, and he could have done it. You know, like we're talking about a person, like we're talking about a black man with capital, with vision, with direction. Like, yeah, you don't want, like, and the thing is that he announced his plans. That was a problem. But like, you don't want, like, if you're Britain, you're not going, because remember that if you're trying to go to another country, you need to get a passport. You know what I'm saying? So they're not going to give you a passport. If they think that you're going to cause some sort of insurrection in their country, they're not going to give you a passport, you know. So that's what it is. It's not so much that he didn't want to; it's that when it came down to, like, when it, like let's be real, when it comes down to it, like, you have to ask this white boy if you can go to another country.
But he had Jamaican citizenship, correct?
Yeah, he had Jamaican citizens, but Jamaica at the time was a colony. Jamaica wasn't Jamaica.
But yeah, that's UK. That would have been UK. Yeah, that's UK. So yeah. The UK didn't want to let him over there to the continent.
No. That's crazy. I mean, because UK own like 40% of the continent, you know? And he's talking about Africa for the Africans, you know? like no, they ain't going, like, no. Like, when he went to Jamaica, they had him on the lock and key, man. Like, it wasn't, like, because the thing is, remember that UK, we got to remember this, that UK don't play. Like, UK colonized America and was like really restrictive. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, to the point where the Americans had to fight the UK. Like it wasn't no joke. Yeah.
You know what that brings me back to, though, when I commented on your post and I had the brother from the Bahamas hit me up with some information like, oh, man, oh, yeah, the Black Americans are so colonized and blah. I said, bro, you're in the Bahamas. Like, like, what is it, 5 guns on that whole island? Like, what are you talking about? Like, like, they literally use your island as a go on sex vacations, bro. Like, damn, white folk lay on your beaches to get tan.
Yeah, but that's true, man. I mean, that's the issue. The rent to roster stuff. It's no joke. Like, I'm saying, man, like, Africa really needs, not just Africa, but the Caribbean and, you know, even Black America really needs some strong leadership. You know,
lack of senior leadership. And going back to the main, because we got off topic. I think that's the problem when you have like ADOS, you know, who's the head of FBA, Black Americans, who knows, you know, LeBron James. I don't know who the hell the leader is. And then you have the Pan-African movement. You know what I'm saying? If you had actually leaders, accepted leaders of every group, now they can sit down and have a conference. They can hash some things out, right? Mm. They can decide on certain goals. They can decide if they even want to work together, right? Or if they're in conflict. But what you have right now is either a bunch of grifters.
Definitely.
Or you have a bunch of just random people on the internet starting stuff because, you know, the person at the Caribbean spot burnt their jerk chicken, so now all, you know, Jamaicans suck. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's
if you're Jamaican and you burning jerk chicken, and you really is shaming all of us. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's nothing wrong with you. what you burning?
Tell something? Me they get it though, man. You got people right, arguing about who invented hip hop. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's
bro. Like, what is this accomplishing? Y'all sitting here pulling up Cool Herc and all these people trying to.
It's a grift, man. It's a grift. Because, like I said, like, you got these people in Kenya. Like, you got people down south, New America, right? Down south in America, like church leaders who are just like they sleeping with the congregation, collecting money, they flying airplanes, so on and so forth. You got this same thing in Africa. But, you know, you come to YouTube, you know, and you want to make a nice buck, you know, like you got to think about like homegirl, Yvette Carnell sitting in front of her computer, like they getting bank, man. If you ever look at their videos, right, they getting, and I'm not saying bank, but they getting money. Like, they getting their bills paid by sitting and talking crap about other people in front of the camera. Like, that's the kind of easy American life that a lot of people want, you know? And she, and you know, if you could just go for like 2 hours, make yourself maybe $1,000, $3,000, you know, just sitting down talking crap, you know, about, oh, we so poor, we ain't got no money, you just getting all this money. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can do that and be successful. Not just that, I want to say this. Some people have said, like, there's a sister named Jam, and she's big on Attack of the AWS, and she was seeing that there was some conservative payouts. You know what I mean? Like, there was some conservative payouts to particularly the ADOS movement. You know, Tariq Nasheed is just a regular grifter. He's just a regular pimp. He sell anything. You know what I'm saying? But like particularly with ADOS, like, there was this element of, you could get some good financing. You know, you could get some, like, because one of the things that they did was they were trying to, I mean, like, it's just common sense. If you start talking bad about the Democrats and you got a big platform, then some Republicans will hand you some money.
So they keep going. Love you, bro.
If I wanted
to not work right now, bro.
Common sense.
Yeah. I would just go be a Black conservative, yo. Because
they
are so desperate to get, because if you're a Black leftist, you're just, you know, you're one drop of water in the ocean. You know what I'm saying? Like,
you know, and the Democrats are like, I don't care about, you know, I don't care, man. You know what I'm saying? I gotta focus on Latinos or something like that, right? You know what I'm saying?
But you talk crazy about the Democrats,
Black conservative. Yeah, man. So that's what I'm saying. Like, she
getting some money, you know?
She was getting some money, definitely. So that was like another part of it. But like, other than that, you know, sitting on YouTube, getting your little, you know, your super chat, you know, you see $500 here and there, and all you got to do is talk about how Harriet Tubman was played by this other woman who didn't have these great opinions, you know? And that, it's like, you know, like, it's not that serious, but you could do that and, you know, get your money. I mean, I'm telling you, man. Cause I know, like, that grift is good. Like, that grift worked. I'll tell you this. Matter of fact, I'm not trying to talk about Tariq Nasheed, but he put up this video, and you know, I could probably stop after this, right? But Tariq Nasheed put up this video where he's like, you know, and nobody gonna talk about these thousands of FBA who went and volunteered in Ethiopia, right? Now here's the thing. Like I said, if you don't control the borders, you really can't do what you're trying to do. Cause there was a lot of volunteers, like 500 volunteers, you know, in Harlem or whatever. And they're trying to talk to the recruiter and they're like, I want to go volunteer in Ethiopia. And the recruiter rejects like all of them, like only like three or maybe one to three people actually got through. Right. Mm. But here's the thing, right? Cause you know, you, like I said, if you got to ask this white boy if you could even go to another country. But here's the thing. When one of the brothers explaining to him, to the recruiter, why he want to go, man's got this thick ass Jamaican accent. You know, like, you know, Toronto, Milwaukee goes, you know, like, you know, damn well, he ain't no FBI. You know what I'm saying? Like, he gonna put up this video of flex, like, all these people is thing. And, you know, Harlem was not, you know, only, you know, quote unquote FBI, but like, you got the one dude, thick ass Jamaican accent. Where I, you know, like, you know, damn, like, it's a grift, man. It's a grift. Like, Tariq Nasheed just raised $1 million on some stupid museum.
Let's see that museum get built, man. I think it is so, and that's like the most despicable thing to me. I hope the museum gets built. I really don't see the damn point, to be honest with you.
No, find it. Like, there's no,
you can make a documentary and put all this information in. I don't really see what's the difference of having a building. Like, why does that empower you more than anything else? Having
it enriches
building, how you got your ass for 400 years. But anyway,
sure. I'm telling you
that, like, and we're the most downtrodden. If you grift from the people at the bottom, you are despicable, yo.
It is
like, that's, I have what, no beef that's, with bank robbers, yo. You're like,
it's so common. That's the issue. It's so common. Like, it's in Africa. It's in America. It's in Jamaica. It's in Trinidad. It's in all, everywhere you go, you got folk grifting off of black folk. It's just one of the easiest things to do.
But my thing is, how you gonna make a documentary on Haiti? Talk crazy about Caribbean people the rest of the time. Like, it's just mine. I'm not trying to make this anything a Tariq Nasheed bashing thing, you know, because I don't need all his cultists in my mentions.
Yeah, right.
I just like him anyway, but I don't care. But it's like,
right, sure.
But come on, man. Like, we collectively have to do better, yo. Mm-hmm. It is so many people you can grift off of, yo. Don't grift, yo.
Like you said, bank robbers. Like, go. Like I'm saying, go do the right thing, man. Yeah, you know.
Go crack some credit cards. Do something. Stop.
Like, say all you want about these Nigerians. They were scamming these white people. You know what I'm saying? I am a prince, you know, blah, blah. Like, at least do that. You know what I'm saying? Don't
call me. It's a rich white woman somewhere that's lonely somewhere. You know, you can do
exactly. You know what I'm saying?
Don't grift your people, though, man.
Here's this museum where I'm going to show you something that I showed you in my documentary. You know, that you raised money. You raised money for this documentary, and then now I sold it to you, and I got made a bunch of money, and now I could, you know, like, this dude living in a mansion. You know what I'm saying? Oh, not a mansion. He living in a good house, though. You know? And he's like, oh, we so poor. And we so, like, come on. And the thing is this, like, you could raise $1 million, you could have raised it for something productive, something meaningful. You know? Something
get a school,
that could generate this. Yeah, something that could generate some income, too. Like, something, but no, you know, it's this, you want to get this light, and nah, whatever, it's whatever.
And then you have so many brothers and sisters out here doing great things, you know what I mean? Like, shout out to King Randall, man. This dude, 21 years old, man, went, got his own school, went and got a bunch of young brothers, teaching them things, taking them places they would have never been before. This dude, 21 years old, bro. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And make impact like that. You could have took that $1 million, gave it to that man would probably have all of Georgia educated. You know what I'm saying?
Like, I'm saying, like, there's smart things you could do. Like, because I'm telling you, he got the charisma somehow. You know? I don't want to compliment him, but, you know, he got this charisma. So, like, it could have been productive, but it's just for grifting. Just for grifting, taking from the lowest, the least, you know? Yeah. Selling them, you know, their names on a museum or something. You know? A museum that nobody really seriously want to attend, because it's
nobody
a lot
asks
of,
for this, bro. Nobody asks. We have so much pressing issues that can be solved. Nobody asks for a museum.
Is that like you complain about black poverty, and then you go like it don't make no sense. You could have done something productive. You got brothers doing the work, like you said, King Randall. You got brothers doing the work, and instead of like saying, you know, elevating them, you know, you trying to like take away from other bro, like from black folk, you know what I'm saying? Like from other black folk to like make this false narrative, you know? I'm telling you, man, have you heard this? Like, you gotta look at this video. Like, this guy just with the deepest Jamaican accent, you know? like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it don't make no sense, man. But anyway, but that's him.
Yeah. I kind of times wish I had was more soulless so I can grift and get some, because I got tools. I just have this thing called a conscience and like to see people.
Damn, man.
So I can't.
You get in the way, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, get in the way. I need to kill that conscience. But,
I'm saying, like if you want some candy and you see a baby and you just like, let him have it. You know what I mean? Yeah. But like grab it sometimes. You know what I'm saying?
Feel that. Let me turn that phone over and take that candy, bro.
I need a Kit Kat. You know what I'm saying? I need a break.
but anyway, man, I ain't gonna take up no more time. We ran a little over, man, and we didn't even get to the last topic, man. That's how much these conversations flow with you, man. I always get the natural chemistry going, bro. I love talking to you.
Yeah,
you're one of my best like followers. And like I said, you inspired me to get into this game, man, with your classic. I ain't gonna go into it, but your classic rant that I sent to pretty much everybody I know. So so shout out to you, man. My brother from another. And I'm gonna leave these last few minutes, man, so you can plug whatever you want to plug, just to wrap up. So if you want to give your business information where people can buy your book, you know, any events, any socials, anything, you know, you got a Patreon, you got, just go ahead. It's your time, brother.
All right. Thank you so much. So fam, I got this book, Pro Black. I got a book, The Book of Power. I got a YouTube channel. I'm on the KWZ Radio Network, along with Harsh Reality Podcast, Bit of Medicine Podcast, and The Learning Curve with Revolutionary Matron. But I'm on the Pro Black Perspective, so check that out. Obviously, if you want to see me on Twitter, I'm at Oni Tase. I do be coming after those socialists and all that, but, you know, it is what it is. But other than that, you know, yeah, just get the book. I want a lot of people to get the book and share the book with other people so that, if nothing else, some of our African leadership, you know, or we can talk to the African leadership and be like, hey, no, let's actually focus on something more meaningful, or let's not sign that document. Let's look it over. And those kind of life skills that we need. But other than that, thank you so much, brother, for having me. You know, always a pleasure to hear from you and to listen to you and your insight and how you really, you know, you really represent that powerful black man that we need more of. So, you know, shout out to you, of course.
Oh, man, I appreciate that to the fullest, especially coming from you with your big book writing self, man. So on behalf of everyone here at the Harsh Reality Podcast, I got to say peace. Salute to Oni, bro.